the topic for this 4 weeks of Dharma exploration is Dogen Zenji's Shobogenzo Komyo. Dogen, our medieval founder, wrote many essays, always about the same thing, but expressed in many different ways. And each one is the central point of his teaching. The Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, has many different eyeballs, and this one is called Komyo, radiant light, brightness, or luminosity. And as usual, what Dogen does is he has some Dharma theme, and then he gathers with, maybe he had some giant Chinese encyclopedia, or he just had an encyclopedic mind, but he gathers like all the Zen stories about the topic he's discussing. So I really appreciate how Dogen does that. So he found some Zen stories that mention this term Komyo, and they're great stories, I think. They're some of my favorite Zen stories or Zen sayings. And then he comments on them. So, light. Dogen in this essay will make clear that he's not talking about physical light, and yet physical light is a great metaphor to point out this inconceivable spiritual light, in the sense that physical light is filling the room right now, and yet we can't see the light directly. We see a lot of things, and we see them because of the light, but what we're seeing is the objects that are illuminated by the light, the surfaces that are illuminated by the light that we can't see. And so we see the effects of light. We see the that which is illuminated by the light, but we can't see the light itself. The way that I'm thinking of describing the light that fills the room right now, we could look at the light fixtures, and they seem to be even brighter. But even then, it's like you could say that the light bulb is actually kind of illuminated by the light, and the light that we see is we can't actually see directly. Does that make sense? So in that way, if light is a metaphor for reality, for this all-pervading present awareness that we are, that is something that we can't actually see directly. We can't get a hold of as some thing that's illuminated, but it is the source of all illumination, particularly if we're talking about this present awareness. It is illuminating everything that we're experiencing. We could even say all our experiences are that which is illuminated by this inconceivable light. And Dogen also uses the term, he quotes the Zen story that uses the term, the radiant light of the self. Jiko Komyo, so like the self light. And so this term self in Buddhism is a tricky term because it can mean different things. We have the term anatman, meaning no self, important teaching of the Buddha, of course. But my understanding is that this atman, of which... this atman of which there is an, or no, this atman that does not exist is Well, in the early teachings, Buddha generally talks about this Atman in relationship to the five aggregates of body and mind. So he's saying, the first time I think Buddha uses the term Anatman, he says, this form or this body is not self, is Anatman. These feelings that are coming and going are not self. These conceptions that the conceptual mind is making are not self. These karmic formations, these habitual tendencies are not myself. These things that we often do identify with ourself, right, are not myself. And even consciousness, a dualistic consciousness, the mind that knows an object separate from itself is the actual definition of vijnana or consciousness in Buddhism. That consciousness is also not myself. So that's generally how anatman is used. It's not so much like an ontological statement of there is no self. Even when the Buddha was confronted once by a monk and said, Buddha, is there a self? And the Buddha said, was silent. And then, well then, is there no self? And the Buddha was silent. And then the monk, I think, was frustrated and maybe left. And as I'm recalling the story, I think Ananda, Buddha's attendant who was there, said, why did you not say there was a self or a no self? And the Buddha said something like, if I said that there was a self, this monk would have grasped onto some idea of a self. And if I said that there was no self at all, he would have gotten confused without more explanation and thinking, well then what is this that I'm experiencing? So it's a subtle point not to be thrown out in these unexplained statements like there is a self or there is no self. We always have to qualify what we mean. And I think that here, when we're talking about the radiant light of the self, self is used not as this identification with the body and mind, five aggregates. It's used in this more large sense of like the true self. In Mahayana Buddhism, self starts getting used again after many centuries of being very cautious about talking about an Atman or a self. Buddha was really into negating in his early teachings. In the Mahayana, some people started saying, we've been negating a long time here in the tradition, so could we say something positive? Especially about this self, our self. So they started using this word Atman again in a positive sense as it might first start getting used this way in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which is a long teaching of the Buddha. It's one of its main emphases is Buddha nature. And Buddha nature, the Buddha speaks of, is as a kind of Atman. Sometimes he uses the word Atma Paramita, the transcendent self, the self beyond self, we could say. Just to qualify that it's not some fixed, graspable kind of self. So, and more practically speaking, we could just, I think the virtues of using the word self, even in Buddhism, are when we're examining our own experience most directly, we can ask questions. In Zen, there's questions like, who is this? It's a little bit like asking, who is myself? Who is my true self? And we say it's actually not the body, the feelings, the conceptions, the habitual tendencies, the dualistic way of perceiving things. It's not those things. And yet, what is it? It seems as if something's happening here, right? What is this self? And we trace back further and further. And we just find this present awareness. And this present awareness, when we start examining what exactly it is, we can't really pinpoint it, right? It's like it's always here. It's the source of all our experiences, just like light is the source of all illuminated visions, visual experiences. This light of awareness is the source of all experiences. In other words, we can't have an experience without the awareness of it, right? So it is like the unchanging source, or it's like who we really are. Usually we use the word self for something that's stable and unchanging. I think usually that's in English and probably other languages. Self is usually used as something that's always present. We can't, if there's something that's truly myself, my true self, it must be always there. You can't have a true self that sometimes disappears. So in that sense, it fits the description of this ever-present awareness. As long as we're having an experience, this ourself as awareness must be present. Yeah, so far? So, with this in mind, just introduce a teaching from this new book that just came out, I think a couple months ago, by Dainin Katagiri Roshi, who is a San Francisco Zen Center teacher, and we have some connection here at Santa Cruz because our late abbess, Catherine Thanis, was a devoted student of Katagiri Roshi. So we have a calligraphy of Katagiri Roshi and hanging in various halls around here.
Did you say he's here now? I thought he was in Minnesota or something.
He's mostly in Minnesota, but he started at San Francisco Zen Center. Yeah. And I don't know if he ever came to Santa Cruz, but I think in the early days, Catherine was his student. And this book is called The Light That Shines Through Infinity. It's a nice title. And it's really about this issue of light. So this, I didn't know this when planning the class, that this book would come out right at the same time as this class, but that's how the light works. So I haven't read through it all yet, but he comments some on this essay, Shobo Genzo Komyo, and another related essay called Shobo Genzo Jipo. Jipo is 10 directions, which we're going to have another session at Jikoji on this 10 directions essay later this summer, and because it's closely related, it's also about light, and it explores one of the same Zen stories from a little different angle. So it's a lot about light here, and I don't necessarily agree with everything that Katagiri Roshi says, but here's a nice point, I thought, near the beginning. He says, in the realm of continuous practice, which is a term of Dogen, that's continuous practice is like the practice that we're always doing. In other words, this one that we're practicing right now. In the realm of continuous practice, there's a great opportunity. You can see the universe coming up as one whole. It's just like a television. Push the button and the myriad beings existing in the vast expanse of the universe immediately come into one screen. That one screen is called the self. So, well, I think I've talked about it in these groups before, the screen. It's a great metaphor, like light. So here it's... you push the TV button and the myriad beings existing in the vast expanse of the universe in the 10 directions immediately come into one screen, and that one screen is called the self. So it's like you can look at a huge landscape of objects and people and events happening in the TV show, but they're all happening on the one screen. What is the self? Category goes on. Is it your small egotistic self? Can you say yes or no? The self is a picture of the whole world coming up, but it's completely free. Sometimes it appears as your individual self. Sometimes it appears as trees, birds, or pebbles. Sometimes it appears as vast space. This is the true picture of the great self you already have. Sometimes this self that we're talking about, right, this ever-present awareness, all-inclusive awareness, appears as your individual self. In other words, it feels like me, Kokyo, like that's stuck in this particular body and these habitual thoughts. That would be like a kind of individual self. So sometimes the big self appears as the individual self, and sometimes it appears as trees, birds, or pebbles. So this is where we're getting into this non-duality and non-separation. Like, you could say sometimes it appears that way. Basically, every time you look at a pebble, it's not at some special time that you look at a pebble. When you look at the pebble and you see the pebble, that's your awareness, right? Your self appearing as this pebble. And you could say, well, that doesn't make sense. Isn't the pebble like, the self's over here and the pebble's over there? But when we're looking at the pebble, is not the pebble that we're looking at in our experience nothing other than actually the seeing of the pebble? In other words, we can't find some pebble other than the seeing of it, the knowing of the pebble. Even if there was one, we only know the seeing of the pebble. We know the knowing of the pebble. And the seeing or knowing is another name for this self. Can you follow? Self is a luminous, cognitive, knowing self. So it knows things through seeing them. When the church bell rings, it hears the bell. But you could say, what are we hearing? We might say, we're hearing the sound of the bell. But really, all we can say really is that there's this hearing happening. There's not like a sound of a bell other than the hearing of it. Or if there is, we don't know about that one. We just know the hearing of the bell. And the hearing is a type of this knowing awareness. Yeah? Some of you have heard this kind of thing before, so we could slow down if it's unfamiliar. Or because this is, I think, the important basis for this essay.
Yeah. For me, it's easier with the hearing. I look at you can't find a division between a self or a person hearing a sound, like the three, the tripartite. Can we more like I hear a sound?
Yeah.
And hearing, if you just look at the sound, you can't really. If you look, you can't find a division that really.
Yeah, you can't. In
vision, you can see the same thing, but I'm sorry. Hearing is the easy one. Mm-hmm.
It may be easier. I think they all the five senses work the same, but it may be that hearing is easier because it's already. It seems like it's not as much of a physical object as something that we see, which is maybe it's a little bit more like easier to relate to as a kind of knowing. I think that's right. Whereas seeing, it's exactly the same principle, but I think that seeing things, they seem more solid, but if we can see them as like the illumination of an object that's illuminated by the light, really what we're seeing is the light playing off of something. And that something we can't really get at. We can just get at the light that's playing off it. The illuminated object, and I think that if we can warm up to this through sound, like you're listening to this voice now, and we normally assume that means there's some sound coming from over here, but in each of our own direct experience, isn't it really that we're just experiencing the hearing, and that the concept of sound, some object called sound that we are hearing, is actually a conceptual idea. I think that's a big statement, because we think, yes, it's just a conceptual idea. I think it's because we've heard about this from a very early age, and people usually talk this way and assume that there is something called sound. So we assume that, and we have heard about how, as Ryan says, even the Buddha taught, there's an ear and a sound, and then the ear consciousness is kind of mediating between an ear and a sound, the tripartite explanation of hearing. So this is kind of like trying to cut through all of these, even Buddha's descriptions, and like come to our direct present experience of just hearing, and not assuming that there's something outside of what we call a hearing, called a sound. And if we can warm up to, if we can start to get the gist of that through hearing, then we can apply the same same principle to seeing, and examine again in our own direct experience. When we're looking at the at this beige color of the floor, is it possible to know that we are just seeing? There's an undeniable experience called seeing a color, you could say. But then what is this color? Can we find the color as something separate or in addition to the seeing? We talk that way. We see the color. But what is the color in addition to the seeing? If we examine experience carefully, there's an undeniable seeing. And really what we call seeing is actually what we call the color, is what I'm proposing. Does this make sense? I mean, can you look at the floor in such a way? Can you look at what's in front of you as it's just seeing? There doesn't have to be a solid object called a floor in addition to the experience of seeing. Does this not ring true for anyone? Because we can explore this further. Is everybody down with this?
Yes and no.
Yeah?
Yes, because it's worth exploring the unknowable, the ungraspable. And then the question is, where do we go from there?
Well, that's another question. This is like, I think we're right now, maybe for a couple classes, we're just really warming up to this different way of, different perspective on the world. And you could say, if we start to shift our perspective in this way, maybe just a little advertisement I could offer is, like, where we go from there is that we hear, there are a lot of teachings like this in the Buddha Dharma, right, about non-duality, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, especially. And I think the purpose of them, or you could say where we go from here, once we really get the hang of this, is the purpose is the complete liberation from suffering of all beings. And you could say that's not really something that we go from there in addition to there. It's more like once we can perceive from this new perspective, it means that we're not separate. It means that the floor is not something other than the knowing of the floor, and this knowing is our true self, and the true self we all share, and therefore we're approaching this true non-duality or non-separation. And when we can start to perceive in this different kind of way, different perspective, then there's this great intimacy between us, and in a way, in the direct experience of this non-duality, I would propose it's impossible to harm another, it's impossible not to love another, and it's impossible not to be beneficial. And as I've sometimes said, sometimes we might doubt this and say, well, sometimes Kokyo might do some unskillful things. And I could say, yeah, I do. And when I do, I'm not in that perspective. And I do have this trust that, like, when I am in that perspective, operating from this perspective, I trust that it is what we might call saving all beings. It is the liberation from suffering for this person and the liberation from suffering for that person. That's a huge statement, I know, but this is why I don't want to advertise too much about this, but we know, I think in the background, that's why these teachings are being presented. And then, without getting too much, we need a little bit of convincing to really put our time and energy into exploring this, otherwise it's just a fun exercise and we don't have that much energy. If we more and more deeply feel this is the key to salvation, then naturally we're going to start, like, reorienting our life, I think, to start putting more and more time and energy into exploring this and coming to being convinced more and more of this view, and any doubts we have about it will be like torture. This is just speaking from my own experience. I'm like a doubting type. Like, the more and more deeply I go into it, and the more and more I feel like there's a flaw in the system, I can't sleep. Because sometimes I'm settled in it, and somebody will bring up a new point from the side, like, then it brings up a doubt. And like, if we don't resolve this right now, this whole practice is a total sham. That's the kind of guy I am. we gotta like clarify the view. And within Buddhism there are different versions of right view, actually. And so we could say this is coming from the Buddhist school of Tathagata Garba or Buddha nature, or I think also the middle way and emptiness teachings, but with a particular luminous twist on them. So anyway, that's a little bit of, I don't want to go too much into how great it would be if everyone realized this, because we've got to spend the precious time of this class to really clarify it. But yes.
Talking about the floor of the bell, like, there's nothing other than the floor is nothing other than, like, the perception of its color, or the bell is merely the perception of its sound, which is not apart from ourselves.
Yeah, you could say the perception, it comes in the, takes the form of seeing or hearing, also takes the form of tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking.
And yet, mm-hmm. to call it a floor feeling. Or a bell is to recognize its qualities that are not merely its sound or not merely its color, it seems to me.
So you could say, hearing the bell, we can project, like, we hear the church bell and we can project a vision, even though we don't see it. We can imagine that it's in the steeple of a church over there and it's shaped like this, and it's made of metal, those kind of qualities.
Well, I mean, even the word itself, that, but even naming it seems to be like to miss.
Yeah, I know.
To be engaging with something in the mind that is not.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean by even the idea of bell, or even the idea of sound, to get even closer, is a conceptual projection that's added on to the direct experience of just hearing, and that's a nice example. Then we can imagine hearing it and imagining that it's a bell and it's shaped like this and it's metal, and that we know that, you know, that may line up with our seeing if we walked over there, but it really is projection, right? In direct, so this exploration is coming from, like, trying to stay with our really direct experience, which is hard to do because we're very conceptual creatures. Yeah.
But it seems like naming has to do with the fact that this amazing thing that we have this shared language.
Yeah, yeah.
This shared
mm-hmm.
know what we're talking about when we say yeah,
bell. It's amazing.
It's a whole other realm of
yeah.
real experience.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we don't discount it. And in fact, Dogen's going to talk about the everyday language and words of practitioners is itself the light also. So that's not, it's not to be discounted, but, I think first we could say, so this is what I'm emphasizing here is like this direct, knowing, preconceptual kind of knowing is not like in a way better, more important than thinking and conversing and so on. But it's a kind, it helps us to understand how we can have this experience of hearing without the need for something external to the knowing. And then we can bring this into the realm of actually talking and conceptualizing, which of course we're doing right now too, that all of this is the light also. But it's easier to, I think, get into the non-separation through direct sensory experience, which is, I think, partly why most meditation practices are silent.
Yeah.
And we try to simplify all the sensory input so that we can really get into the nuances of it. Mm-hmm. So, Katagiri Roshi goes on in this vein that the self that sometimes appears as your individual self, sometimes it appears as trees, birds, or pebbles. Sometimes it appears as vast space. Maybe when there's no particular thinking going on, it's just total vastness. This is the true picture of the great self you already have. Your true self is not something separated from others. It is interconnected and constantly working with others. Where? Not in your own small territory. It's working in the huge universe. In Japanese, that working is called komyo, or light, or radiant light. The functioning energy of the whole world is the light of the self. Because light is working from moment to moment, the whole world constantly manifests itself as the human world. At that time, the whole world is within the light of the self, which is a line from Changsha that Dogen's going to quote here. The whole world is within the light of the self. So, before we jump into Dogen, just to give a little background of the use of this term light in the Buddhist tradition before Dogen. I think Zen people really got into this light image in China, but the Pali Canon, the early foundational teachings of the Buddha, there's one classic sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, right, which is like arranged by numbered lists. So this is the Book of the Ones. the Book of the Eights would include like lots of sutras about the Eightfold Path and so on. So in the Book of the Ones, it's very fitting that this sutra about light is in the Book of the Ones. And it's called the Pabhasara Sutta. Pabhasara means luminous or light or luminosity. And the Buddha says, luminous, monks, is the mind, and it is obscured by obscurations. The uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person doesn't discern that as it actually is present, which is why I tell you that. For the unobstructed, run-of-the-mill person, there is no development of the mind. And I think commentaries often say development means like awakening of the mind, because this luminosity of this mind is obscured by obscurations. We could say, what kind of obscurations? In the way we've been talking, you could say the concept of the bell seems to obscure the light that is the direct knowing experience of hearing the bell. So you could say the idea of an object other than the direct all-inclusive knowing, the hearing, some other object in addition to that is what we call an obscuration. When we're looking at that, that obscures the luminosity. We could say, it doesn't really obscure it. Nothing can really, and I think the Buddha would agree, nothing can really obscure the light. Everything is the light. But it seems to obscure the all-encompassing knowing, because then it's more like, I'm over here knowing the bell over there. And that duality, that illusion of duality, is obscures the all-embracing, non-dual light. Yes?
Would you or the sages consider thoughts as obscurations?
Yeah, in the same way that they seem, to nuance this, that nothing really, from the ultimate perspective, nothing really obscures. But yeah, thoughts are maybe the major thing that seems to obscure non-dual awareness, because thoughts are inherently dualistic, and they appear to be dualistic. They're always about something, and they always seem to have like a subject, a sense of a subject thinking about some object. They seem to appear in that dualistic way.
I take it more like the relationship of the light to the content. So like the thoughts, because it can be thoughts, and if the relationship is, like you're saying, I'm fixating on something over here, navigate this thing I think that's the obscuration of that.
Mm-hmm.
This is much my opinion.
Mm-hmm. We could say the content of thought, which is like kind of believing and reifying the story of what we're thinking about. And
but the thoughts themselves, you can have thoughts that aren't, if you're not,
mm-hmm.
it's just like the sounds or it's the
breath. Yeah. It's
the relationship to the content.
Yeah.
It's not content.
I think we could say that, yeah. If we don't grab a hold of the content and think that it's something other than knowing, in this case, other than, which is another name for light. Light is awareness or knowing or luminosity or the self. These are all synonyms here. If we think thoughts are just like the self overflowing into this amazing, as Helen says, amazing activity of being able to think thoughts and then agree on language and converse and convey deep feelings and experiences to each other. It's totally amazing. But when we think that all this is something other than the light, then we could say that's the obscuration. And I feel like that's what I usually do, especially if it's a difficult conversation. Maybe more loving conversations, they seem like they are more in accord with the light, actually. But a difficult conversation, it seems like there's this believing what we think, where like, it's often has somebody's thought is disagreeing with somebody else's thought, right? And that this is creating this tension, and if we're into that content, that seems to really obscure this light, which is this light is always peaceful. That's one of its qualities. Yeah.
It could also be that another word is dominance. It's like what Ryan was saying, maybe I think about hearing. I mean, when I go to a music concert, a classical music concert, I close my eyes to hear because the visual is so dominant.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, and it could be that the thinking, the conversation mm-hmm. also is a dominant thing that just obscures other.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Often in concerts they turn the lights down, mm-hmm. maybe for this reason, mm-hmm. so you can really get into the sound. Mm-hmm. But of course, you can, the light can take multiple forms at the same time, like we're seeing and hearing right now. But the more senses we involve, the harder it is to remember. We start to get overwhelmed by the experiences or the content, when there's more going on So that's why meditation is so nice, to just simplify. So the Buddha goes on this about these uninstructed, run-of-the-mill people are obscured. But then he says, luminous monks is the mind, and it's freed from obscurations instead of defiled or obscured by them. The well-instructed disciple of the noble ones discerns that as it actually is present, which is why I tell you that for the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, there is development of mind, or there is awakening. And I think it's interesting that these ones who are not obscured have heard these teachings. It's about, you know, instructed or uninstructed, which I think is a great point, that we can just be in our direct experience, but without ever having, this is subtle stuff, right? Even though it's totally obvious, at the same time, our obscurations are so habitual that we need some instruction to shift our perspective. Like Dogen says in the Jijiyu Zamai, the self-fulfilling samadhi, he says, from the first time you meet a teacher, or one who instructs you in the samadhi, then just wholeheartedly sit and drop off body and mind without need for any other practices. But kind of, you could say, how about just sitting without careful instruction and what that means? Dogen might say, then it doesn't work. That's why I put that part in. So that's one early sutta about this light.
What was the first line of the sutta again? Illumination is the work of the mind.
Luminous or bright or light, monks, is the mind. The mind is pabhasara.
Light.
Yeah. Or in Sanskrit, prabhasvara. Or prabha means light. Aloka also means light in Sanskrit. And another early sutta about light. There aren't that many of them, really. But these ones, I think, fit this teaching very nicely. This one is the Kevada Sutta from the Long Discourses, number 11. And the line that leaps out here is, and I think this is what Rick brought up the other night for some of you who are here in the talk. I think this is maybe what he was referring to. The Buddha says, where consciousness is signless, boundless, and all luminous, it's the same term, pabhasara, where consciousness is signless, boundless, and radiant light, or luminosity, that's where earth, water, fire, and air find no footing. There, both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, there, name and form, all of these are completely destroyed. Or we could say completely not there. Unfindable as separate things. He uses the word consciousness, but you could say, isn't consciousness this dualistic knowing of something else? You could say, yeah, but when that dualistic consciousness, this very dualistic consciousness that is me thinking that you're out there, this consciousness, when this one is signless, means like the things out there, the signs that we see out there are not out there. When it's boundless, boundless also means that there's nothing outside it. If consciousness had a boundary, there would be something other than it. But if it has no boundary, it therefore means there's nothing in addition to it. That's what boundless means, right? So when this consciousness, this dualistic consciousness, is recognized to actually be signless, boundless, and all radiant light, then the physical elements, earth, water, fire, and air, have no footing. They find no place to take hold.
these dualistic concepts like long and short, small and great, pleasant and unpleasant, and so on, name and form, conceptualizing phenomena, all of this is destroyed. A strong word. But we could say it's not really destroyed because it doesn't exist in the first place, but you could say that the grip on it, the reification of it, the investment in the content of it, that's destroyed. And there's peace.
And life, suffering, and salvation are all destroyed.
Yeah, the life as we know it, salvation and suffering drama. And drama, yeah.
All destroyed. And saving salvation.
Yeah, yeah.
To admit it.
Yeah, destroyed. Destroyed. As we know it. Yeah, everything.
Ajahn
Shanti has a nice book called The End of Your World. It's like, there's no more world. Yeah. But of course, you can still talk and dance and eat and play music.
And vow to save each other.
And vow to save each other. But there's not really a world anymore.
No.
Yeah. You could even say, knowing that there's really not a world is, we love the world even more. Because you could say our love of the world is now somewhat obscured by thinking it exists the way we think it does. That's like limits our love. That's my understanding of...
I'm going to buy that.
The book is The End of Your World?
The End of Your World.
Which, yeah.
And you could say there is no the world other than your world. We could put in parentheses. But yeah, your gives a clue. That this world, any world you know of, is your world. Mm-hmm. And awakening is at the end of your world. Yeah. So there's another Mahayana sutra, early Mahayana, the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines, which is, I think some say, the first Prajnaparamita sutra. Probably around the year zero. It's a good year for Prajnaparamita to... It's a good vintage of Prajnaparamita sutras. It's the year zero. The Buddha says, the mind of the Buddha is never stopped. It was never produced. It has no duration in between production and stopping. It gives no support. It's infinite since it cannot be measured, and it's inexhaustible, like the Dharma Dhatu itself, like the universe itself. And the Tathagata knows obscured minds of beings for what they are, similar to this other sutra. The Buddha knows that the minds of ordinary people are not actually obscured by the obscuring forces of wrong views, which, being nothing but just wrong ideas, don't really find a place in this boundless mind. It's a great part of the sutra, I think. What we think of obscurations are not really obscuring the mind because they don't find a place, they find no footing there. The Tathagata knows unobscured thoughts for what they are. For the Buddha knows that those minds of all beings are transparently luminous, prabhasvara, a radiant light in their essential original nature. So there's some early suttas using this word, luminosity or radiant light, and a Mahayana sutra. And I think they're used in the same sense of what is this light? We can't really say what it is. We can't get a hold of it, and yet it's undeniably ever-present. It's the light that makes all experience possible. As long as we're having any experience that we could call an experience, even if we have no names to call it that at the time, but afterwards we said, that was an experience. Anything in the realm of experience
must be experienced by ourself. Therefore, we've never not known ourself. We have never not been this experiencing self. You could say, what about that time when I didn't have an experience? Well, you want to talk about a time you didn't have an experience? any time that we're, anything that's ever happened to us has been this light, has it not? Does that make sense? Has been ourself, right? You could say, this sounds so basic, of course. And yet, the implications here are, now we can start to investigate this, this self, this light. We can't get a hold of it. We can't investigate it in that way, but we can discern its qualities, by kind of asking questions about it or to it in our direct experience. Like, well, has there ever been a time when this light has not been present? Apart from all our ideas about when it might not be, have I ever experienced not I? Have I ever experienced when there hasn't been this light? Even when I'm totally distracted, totally half asleep, even when I'm dreaming, that's like the light of knowing is always here. So you could say that fits the criteria of myself, because it's not something that comes and goes. And it fits the criteria, I would say, too, of the Buddha's teachings of emptiness, because it's totally ungraspable. So emptiness means that you're looking at something, it's empty. One way to say that is it cannot be grasped by the mind in any possible way. And this knowing is like that. It's if we get a hold of it, even the slightly get a hold of it, that's making it into an object. So therefore we can deduce in our own experience. And I like to do this even in Zazen, because it, like, you can more and more directly and calmly and unhinderedly come to a more and more strong conviction, really, that there is a realm here that cannot be lost. And also we can explore the implications of, not only is it boundless because we can't find anything outside of it, we have never in our life ever found anything outside of our knowing, right? I hope. If we think we have, it doesn't make sense, right? Because all we have is the knowing of it. So therefore, there's no evidence that it has boundaries. And does that make sense? That boundaries means there's something outside of it. So we could say there may be something outside of it, but we, so far in our life, I can read your minds. I know your experience because it's like mine. And that, but you can confirm this for yourself, that you've never had an experience of something outside of this knowing. Therefore, there's no evidence that this awareness, this light, is not boundless. Does that make sense? You can confirm in your direct experience over the course of your life so far that this knowing that's present right now is boundless. Did you follow that? Boundless means we have never found any boundaries to this knowing.
Yeah, you can confirm that.
Yeah.
That's, I haven't found any.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
I just confirmed the boundlessness of awareness. That's now you're no longer a run-of-the-mill, uninstructed disciple.
I was feeling bad.
Of course, it's very easy then to forget this. And also, it's easy to forget it. And also, at this point, we might say, yeah, that's cool. Wow, this light of awareness is boundless. We might say, but so? What about my problems? I still got them.
damn, we start, you know, applying this new understanding. And as soon as we start to slip into confusion, then we can come back to, like, let's confirm again the boundlessness, not as an idea, but in our direct experience.
As a freedom.
As a freedom, yeah. That's part of the implications here, is that this, you could say, freedom from suffering. We can examine this issue now. We could say, I know I've suffered in this life, but if I more and more can just rest as this boundless awareness, there can still be stuff happening. We can still be having a conversation at the same time as there's a boundless awareness. We just know that everything that's happening is within this knowing light, right? Then we could say the knowing light itself has this ungraspable boundless light. Has it ever suffered? This is a super important exploration. Has it ever suffered? You say, yeah, because I've suffered. And we could say, okay, we pick an experience of suffering, and that clue, that sentence already gives a clue of what's going on here, because this experience of suffering is an experience, right? And the experience is the noun that is, it's the thing that's known by this light, right? So the suffering is not the light itself, but there is a knowing of the suffering. Does that make sense? Like, if you might have some suffering right now, or you can imagine some. You could say, at the time of suffering, I feel like I was completely identified with the suffering. So I was so caught up in it that there was no other light other than that. But even if we're totally caught up in it, if we look at it now, we can discern, because every experience is like this, that there is a knowing of that experience. And the knowing of it is always the same. Yeah. It can take different forms, like seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and thinking, but all those different types of knowing are all basically the same light of knowing. Can you follow that one? This knowing, like right now we're seeing and hearing. Those are two different types of knowing. But those two types of knowing are basically really the same knowing. And this knowing that, again, is boundless and it has no qualities really and it's ungraspable. We could say it's different types of knowing. Of the same knowing. That's an important point. Can you follow that one? That seeing and hearing are two types of, we could also call them experiencing, two types of experiencing. But the experiencing, there's really just one experiencing always happening, but it can manifest or it can express itself, it can take the form of hearing and seeing and thinking and tasting and feeling and emoting. But do you see how all those could be seen as like really just one experiencing? You follow that? This experiencing is another synonym for the light, knowing, awareness. Yeah, experiencing. And the experiences are like the sound of the bell, the color of the floor, the pain in the knee. So, and the pain in the knee might be unpleasant. We call it dukkha. We call it dissatisfying sensation. And then you would call it suffering. Discontent. I'm discontent with the feeling in this knee right now. That's an experience. And this pain in the knee is known by this awareness. Is it not? And it might be getting more and more, so it's like throbbing and intensely piercing pain. But the awareness, actually, that is not in pain, right? It's just clearly, equally observing whether it's intense pleasure, intense pain, color, sound, taste, emotion. See how all those things are like objects. Or also, these are synonyms. Object of mind. Experience is another name for object. They're kind of like things that seem to be separate from us. Like the floor is an... We're experiencing the color of the floor,
it seems to be separate from the knowing of it, but when we examine closely, we can see there is just the knowing of the floor. Same with the pain in the knee. We might say, that doesn't seem separate from me, but I would say the me, in a way, I think it is, it's a dualistic experience. There's like a mind that's aware of this pain. I think, and because it's dualistic, the pain seems, if we start to examine, it seems a little bit separate from me. That's what makes it so painful. Any dualistic experience is going to be unsatisfying and painful. So even though it's in this body, you might say my body, the fact that I would propose that the self that we feel ourselves to be is really like this awareness. And the body is, we could say, mine. It belongs to this awareness. So it's so close to us. And we think that it is me, we sometimes think. But I think when it's strongly painful, we separate from the body, actually. We feel like the body, it's something bad's happening to my body. It's not happening to me, the awareness. And that's the problem, in a way, you could say. If we could recognize during the knee pain, be the knowing, be the awareness, instead of like identifying with the knee pain itself, right? Be the knowing of it. Then there's like this, in a way, you could say a kind of a separation from the pain. But just in order to confirm that right in the middle of what we call suffering, there's one who's actually not suffering. This is really important to be able to confirm. We still say, but I want the knee pain to go away. Okay. I know, Kokyo, you do. But before we make it go away, let's first discern that the one who actually could care less whether the knee pain goes away or not, because it's just knowing an experience. It has no judgment over this experience is a good one and this is not a good one. It's completely equanimous with every experience. So therefore, you can imagine the implications if we start identifying with this awareness that's always this, always lovingly embracing, you could say, every experience. Maybe that's too biased. Just equanimously, peacefully, experiencing every experience, and it is not suffering, then it makes sense that you could have Buddha who has dysentery and all his body trouble near the end of his life, but he says, I am completely free from dukkha. I have realized the end of suffering. But Buddha, you're like pooping all over the place and your robes and you're like, your back is in excruciating pain. There's no dukkha here. And yes, there's like intense stuff going on in the back of this body. So that's one way to look at this, right? People say it's not really possible to be totally free from suffering. It doesn't mean that you don't have dysentery and back pain, right? But there's one who's already, for all of us, already completely free from suffering. It's a matter of we're not identifying with the body and mind that's suffering. We're identifying with our self, our true self called Komyo, radiant light.
Yeah. I was wondering if it just keeps going on. Can you know the knowing? You know, is there enough? Does it just keep going?
Well, yeah, you might say, is there an infinite regress or something? Mm-hmm. But no, not really, because you could say, in a way, being aware of awareness, or being aware of being aware, mm-hmm. You could say it sounds like there's two different things there. But actually, it's not. It's more like we could say being aware of being aware sometimes is presented as a practice. Another way to say that would be just being aware, or being awareness is another way of saying being aware of being aware. It's not really like there's one awareness aware of another, because if there was, that would make the awareness that we're aware of into another object. So that's part of what we have to, you know, work out in the meditation here, is if we start to do this splitting into two, one watching the other, then we know we've subtly, usually it's quite subtle at this point, we've subtly made the knowing into something that we can
sort of call an object or an experience or something to get a hold of. So it's more like we're just being the awareness that we already are, and there's no more regression, there's no more awareness of that one. Because, and we can confirm this ourselves by asking us, you know, investigating. You see, in Zazen is, you know, when we're quiet and we have some time, it's nice to check out. Could there even possibly be another one behind that that knows this one? And I think we can come to the conclusion that, like, no, it's not possible. Because we're only talking about our actual experiencing right now. There's nothing kind of mystical or hidden in this realm at all. It's only, we want to talk, we use the language of obscuration, in the sense that it seems to be temporarily blocked by, we're paying attention to the object so much that we've forgotten the knowing, or, you know, in the screen metaphor, right? We're so into the movie, or on the TV screen, that we forgot that we're actually just looking at a screen. That's normal for all of us sentient beings. But the screen's always there. We're always, and we're actually, it's not even hidden by the image on the screen, right? It's, you could even say this, the screen is revealing itself to us through the picture on it. We're actually just looking at the picture. This is a metaphor for exactly what we're talking about, of we're just seeing the screen. It's like we're seeing the awareness, the knowing. But it seems like what we're seeing is this movie, and it starts to seem three-dimensional. We're getting involved in the emotions of the characters on the screen, which is nice to do. That's why we like the movies. But at the same time, we can step back and remember, this is a movie.
So Arya just heard this, but it's coming to mind. So if we become pure awareness, and call that liberated, then if we get that, there's no one there to appreciate it.
There's no, like, separate self to appreciate.
There's no one there to... And the joke or the koan goes, you don't want enlightenment, because if you get it, there'll be no one, you won't be there to appreciate it.
In a way, you could say that, but you could also say, there won't be anyone to appreciate it as another experience. But there would be great happiness.
By who? In what way?
The awareness itself. We could say it.
Awareness will be happy?
Well, I would say this is a nice point. It's not that awareness will be happy, that happiness is another name for this awareness. We got another synonym now. Radiant light, awareness, knowing, experiencing, happiness, and self. Yeah, this self. This is another clue, we might say, like, the Anatman, Buddha says, these things are not self. Any self that's suffering is Anatman. It's not the self we're talking about, right? But this self is also called Nirvana, and Nirvana is the end of suffering. It's content, it's peaceful, and Buddha would even go so far as to sometimes call it bliss. But then, I think he didn't call it that often, because then you're like, I want that, and then make it into an object. So he's like, let's just be cool about this Nirvana thing. If we get into how blissful it is, we're like, give me that. It's like, no, actually, let's just say it's the end of suffering. But what is the end of suffering? It's actually bliss. Well, it's happiness.
I'm glad you like it. It's naming the nameless.
Yeah, well, all this is naming the nameless. So
I like it.
Yeah. But you could say, yeah, the I that likes things and dislikes things, that one won't be around to, at least in a real way, to appreciate it. It might be like, you could say there might be this residual thing like Kokyo, the body-mind Kokyo, be like, yeah, I did it. I actually got to this thing that I wanted to get to, and I did. And then, you know, but there's also this, because we operate that way as humans, but there could also, at the same time, there would also be a voice like, yeah, that's kind of funny. Yeah, you did get it, Kokyo, but like, you already had it. And like, how lame of you to finally think that you got something that you already had. I mean, it's kind of a joke, right? So it's kind of lame, Tokyo, but it's kind of cute too, and it's nice that you, Kokyo, are happy. And now, because now you can join me, the awareness that was already happy. Now we're kind of like, we're together. together we can do like great work in this world. Because usually it's like, I'm here ready to help, just loving everybody. But you, Kokyo, keep thinking all these things that like, oh, I can't do it and all that stuff. So we're getting a little late here. I think we should jump in. Dikomyo. Do you have a quick one?
I don't know if it's quick or not. The question's quick. I don't know if the mm-hmm. response is quick.
What's the question?
Maybe if it's a long response, we can skip it now. You said we can identify with awareness, and that language resonates mm-hmm. with me really deeply because I think I have this imperfect understanding where it really does feel like I don't think you meant it this way necessarily, but it's like there's this decision I have, you know, like look over here. It's like it's not merely pain in the knee. It's mm-hmm. just energy or experience mm-hmm. or whatever. Or there's like, this really sucks. I want to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's just this decision to switch to like maybe just feeling it.
Yeah.
But the trouble with that is that it seems like then there's awareness, and then there's some kind of grasping or something mm-hmm. to not wanting it. And it seems like there's this other awareness here that has a decision to like pivot or look whatever direction.
Well, let's keep...
It's like, well, what is actually the awareness? And this thing doesn't feel very free of suffering because it can choose to look over here at the grasping.
Well, to keep it simple, yeah. Let's stay with this identification point because I think this is just a good word here. As I understand it, to identify with means to actually be one with something. So to have the same identity as something. So we say, I identify with your problems means like I feel a kind of oneness connection with your problems. That's one way to look at this word, identification. And I think what the Buddha is saying is that we usually, all beings usually strongly identify means they identify with their body and mind. They identify with their five skandhas as their self. You could say they identify with. They are one. They think they are one. They are their five skandhas.
But my thing is like, who's do what's doing?
Well, wait a second. Let me just finish this story. So we think we are the five skandhas. We identify with them, and that it's an unconscious identification. So we can disidentify with. Through hearing these teachings and contemplating them, we can consciously shift our identification with the body and mind to the knowing light of awareness, and identify with that. And we'd say, isn't that like kind of making a self? In a way, you could say we're just shifting our identification with this. And I think it's okay. I feel it's okay to say I'm identified now with this awareness. Is there some grasping there? It's more like I am one with the awareness. That's who I am. And is there grasping? It cannot be grasped. Mind cannot be grasped, the Buddhas and ancestors say. So and if we can if we think we can grasp it, then that's something in the body and mind. It's something in the five skandhas. Everything that can be grasped fits into the five skandhas. But this one doesn't. It's the knowing of the five skandhas. And so it's shifting our identification.
It's still very confused. It still seems like there's something pivoting. There's something deciding not to look at that or someone.
Who's making the shift? Is an interesting one too. You could say, it's the mental factor called intention that's deciding, and that intention is all mental factors are conditioned. In this case, we're being conditioned by the Buddhas and ancestors to like look in a different way. And then you could say that shifts the intention. That'd be a kind of a way of talking about it from the point of view of the person. But we could also say, really, it's the light itself. It's just yearning for us to recognize it and just be it. It's saying, Kokyo, just you think you're this body and mind, but you're me, the awareness, and if you could just remember, I'm already here. If you just remember me, you're totally free and you can be so much more helpful to other people. And I don't want to hear it, not right now, as you could say. But you could say the shift could be done by actually the awareness.
Because the life's dynamic. It's not static. Hmm. It's like a feature of the life that it's dynamic. Like,
mm-hmm.
That Buddhism, they talk about those three characteristics of Rigveda, you know, one's openness, one's luminous, and then the third is this dynamic unimpededness, so it has this dynamic quality to it. That's how I understand the pivot life. It's actually the light. It's yourself, the light. That's the move here, you constrict, or you...
Which is also often connected with compassion, too. Yeah. It naturally... by its very nature, it cannot resist anything. So if there's some suffering around, I don't want to deal with that suffering. It can't do that. It is just like, I open to you, like suffering being, and I know what you are, me, actually. And I think that's one way of looking at compassion as a quality of Buddha nature, which is also taught in the Indian sutras and shastras. So just to finish off, the beginning here, because here's the story, the Zen saying. It's not so much of a story. It's in a formal talk, Changsha, great master Zhao Xian of Hunan, great Song China, said, "The entire world of the 10 directions is a Shramana's single eye." Shramana, or as it says, monk. And I think the etymology of shramana means like, some people etymologize it as making effortful activity. So sometimes they translate it as ascetic, but also has this quality of sama, meaning shrama, meaning like peacefulness and contemplation. So I think a nice contemplation, Ajahn Chah Nisero translates shramana as contemplative. So it doesn't have to be a monk. But I think it is pointing to one who's contemplating these teachings. See, we could say a practitioner. The entire world in the 10 directions is a contemplative's or a practitioner's single eye. The entire world of the 10 directions is a practitioner's everyday speech. The entire world of the 10 directions is a practitioner's entire body. The entire world of the 10 directions is the radiant light of the self. Jikko Komyo. The entire world of the 10 directions is within the radiant light of the self. In the entire world of the 10 directions, there's not a single person that is not the self. And some translators, there's not a single person that is not myself, or there's not a single person that is not themselves, but there's no pronouns really in Chinese. It's just the jikko, the self. And then Dogen says, make sure to endeavor in the practice of the Buddha way, or he uses this word, sangaku, to thoroughly study and investigate. Dogen's into this investigation. Those who practice should not be coarse or distant. Even so, there have been few practitioners of the way who have mastered this radiant light or have studied and attained this radiant light. So this you can read ahead if you'd like this and bring them next time. And Dogen will comment a little bit more on this story, but I think it'd be nice to go through each of these lines, because it's one of my favorite these days, Zen stories about luminosity.
What's your name?
My name is Luminous Owl. Kokyo.
He's so self-involved.
The owl that is not really some kind of bird, but it's just really luminosity. And the Chinese characters here, this is the ko of luminous owl.
Like light.
Yeah, it looks like light radiating. Mm-hmm.
It looks like a
and it means light or luminous. And the other one character, the left part, this little square on the left, is the character for sun in China and Japan. And the right one is the character for moon. So when you put together sun and moon, it means light or radiance or luminosity. So they both mean almost the same thing. You put them together, the Katanahashi, radiant light is nice because it emphasizes, but you could also translate it as just brightness or luminosity. And it's also, komyo is used for halos of Buddha, and like auras are like halos. But this essay gets kind of into this, and there's experiences that look like halos and light that can be seen. And the critique is, if you think you can see something, that's not this light we're talking about. But it might be an expression of the light. So these are some things you can contemplate and bring back. I mean, you can especially bring back questions if it's like, I have some doubts about my true self is completely boundless and has never suffered. That's like a big statement, like, wait a second. So like, especially about these points, does it make sense to confirm that our ordinary present awareness, the light of knowing right now, has no boundaries and it has never suffered. And it is not an experience and it cannot be grasped. These are all qualities we check out, really confirm for ourselves. Thank you. Yeah. You want me to stop?
There's nothing apart from the hour.
Every night.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.